Good morning, everybody. How are you doing today? Gee whiz, what a great class. 2 weeks ago, I got up and I thought, I've got to teach for Wayne today. So I went over to the chapel and I waited. No one came. They said, well, maybe Wayne's class is over here. So I then came over. So I didn't start till last week. So I was 2 weeks. 2 weeks off, which is so me. Imagine a person like myself. I've been described as a person, a piece of grease in a hot pan, and it pops when it gets hot. As contrast to Dr. Grudem, who dots his I's and crosses his T's and lives such an incredible, disciplined life. No one could have a better experience in the whole world than writing a book with Wayne Grudem. And I'm glad it's over, very glad it's over. But I am sad also that Wayne and I won't be touching base almost daily, twice a day, five times a day, and so on. So it's just been a great, great experience to do that. Jamie kind of teed it up last week by saying, what values are we going to bring into the voting booth? What values? And how might that affect how we're going to vote? And I've never felt this strongly before about wanting to pray for our country as much as I have the last 6 months. And so there's lots of groups across the country that are praying for this country, 6 in the morning and 6 in the evening. And I just made a commitment to do that. This morning I beat it by 2 hours. For whatever reason, I was up at 4, so I was in great shape to pray at 6. But 6 in the morning, 6 in the evening. And we have a lot of our friends, and we know a lot of people. I was just in Oklahoma City this week, and there was a whole group of people I met with one evening at a home. There were about 35 of them, and all of them are praying for our country on a regular basis. So on positions, the best position that we can take is on our knees. So I'm going to start there, and then we're going to go from there. What I'd like to do is I'd like to review just a little bit of what Jamie said last week, present a couple of other things, and then see where you're coming from as to how you see the importance of this election. Father in heaven, be with precious Wayne and Margaret this weekend in their ministry. Thank you for Wayne taking his own personal time and money to go to Florida and other swing states and give great messages to pastors, encouraging pastors to have their people vote. Lord, it is true that half of the evangelicals in America didn't vote in the last election. And certainly it would be our wish and hope that they would. But that's going to be up to you, Lord, as you lead people's hearts and their lives. We are so blessed with abundance and joy of what this country has brought every one of us. And so there's all kinds of reasons why we love this country and all kinds of reasons why we would probably want to vote and make a vote difference and make a count. Bless this day now, and we're going to ask your protective wing over what is said and done. Thank you for the class. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Jamie talked about values and right to life. And so that was the first thing. We go into the voting booth and say, how important is it? And of course, in our country, that decision is going to be decided pretty much by the Supreme Court. But interestingly enough, this next president will be maybe making one or two or three appointments to the Supreme Court. People feel so strongly about either right to life or choice that it's really hard to get much discussion in between. But I think the Bible, as Jamie said last week, makes it so clear that God is so interested in life even as it begins in the womb. And so I just love that Jamie right away went to Psalm 139, where King David is saying, you've searched me and you know me. And this whole psalm is about the omniscience, omnipotence, and the presence of God. And he says, you know, you've searched me and you know me. You know when I'm going to stand up and you know when I'm going to sit down. You know all about my plans. You know all about my actions. You know all about my ways. You know every word that I'm going to speak before I've even spoken a word. How can it be? What an omniscient God that we have. Oh God, where am I going to go to get away from your presence? Where can I go to flee from your spirit? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I descend into hell, you are there. If I take the wings of morning and go to the deepest part of the ocean, even there your hand will hold me and your right hand will guide me. Even when darkness befalls me, night shall be as light about me. Even darkness can't separate me from you. Oh God, you are truly a wonderful God. You're truly omniscient and you're omnipresent. And then Jamie read in Psalm 139 about God talking about, he knows us even from our mother's womb. He's knitted us together while we're in our mother's womb. And it's so beautifully said in the ESV. And so we'll look at that. You don't have to. You can just listen for a second. Psalm 139, it says, "For you formed my inward parts." God knows the baby in the womb. "You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you. I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well." Listen, "my frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your books were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet I hadn't even lived one day." And so this wonderful God that we serve, omniscient, omnipresent, and all-powerful, even knitting us together in our mother's womb. Point that, you know, life, yes, life's very important, both in the womb and out of the womb, and life truly, truly deserves protecting. And so I think Jamie set that up as maybe one of the values that we would want to bring into the voting booth next in the election coming up. He talked about same-sex marriage and went through quite a discourse on what could be the consequences of treating this idea lightly of same-sex marriage. 7 or 8 states have it. Most states are against it. And so we'll just have to see what God would have each of us do and what happens as far as state governments making up their mind. But that one probably also could be decided by the Supreme Court, just like Roe versus Wade. They don't care what the public thinks. It's what 5 out of the 9 judges think. And so makes every election so, so very important as to who might be in there. The third thing Jamie talked about was freedom. And that's one of my favorite subjects, as you all know. But in Galatians 5:1, here's what Jamie read last week on freedom. He said this, "For freedom Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery." So as Wayne and I have got to travel some of the world and write this book entitled The Poverty of Nations, if we could have a wish, if we could have a dream for them as far as how to increase the prosperity of your nation, we definitely would say number one is economic freedom. When you can allow people to choose, allow people to own, allow people to trade, allow people to buy and sell, allow people to hire and fire, all those freedoms that we just absolutely take for granted. But you don't know how bad it is unless you, if you don't have them. And it's so encouraging to find out in the world's coming to understand that freedom really is the mainspring of economic prosperity. And even a country like China, which 30, 40 years ago was stuck and had been stuck for hundreds and hundreds of years. China was quite a civilization from 10 AD for the next five centuries. And then about by 1600 AD, it's just a non-player. And it's a non-player not because of only some bad emperors, but then communism in the 20th century gripped a hold of China. And you just have 1.3 or 1.4 billion people in abject poverty. And then, talking about freedom, here you have thousands of farmers in a little inner province way a long ways from Beijing, 2,000 miles from Beijing. And they said, you know what? Collectivized agriculture is going to kill us. Collectivized agriculture, we're all going to starve to death. And so they made a little pact. How about we each have our little plots, grow on them, and keep what we work? And they began to do that. And all of a sudden, when Mao Zedong died in 1977, Deng Xiaoping, who took over, had heard that there's something going on about 2,000 miles from here that they seem to be able to create a whole society of prosperity. And so Deng Xiaoping, the new premier of China, flies or goes there, however it was, probably flew, and said, what is going on out here? And premier, just to be quite honest with you, collective farming was killing us. We were all starving to death. And now we've divided this up, and we all have our little plots. And Deng Xiaoping just turned on a dime and began to shift China to way more economic freedom, to allow the Chinese to move where they want, to allow the Chinese to have some economic freedom. Now, don't get me wrong. It's a million miles away from freedom the way you and I would understand it. I have to tell you that we spent 10 days in China and in Beijing, and on our last night in Beijing, six or eight underground pastors came and met with, certainly not with me, but I got to be in the room, and met with Dr. Grudem, and they were so excited to see him. And all we can tell you is that as we heard how they are being persecuted, our hearts just broke, and we just did a lot of crying that night. On the other hand, I've seen this for 2 years, and to see Wayne go and put his arms around the pastor and pray for that pastor in such a personal way, the words that God gives Wayne on names and wife and children and church and difficulties and diseases and beautiful prayers. Beautiful prayers. So, same-sex marriage, life, freedom. China is now on the uptake. They are being given some economic freedoms. And as you give Chinese economic freedoms, you all know that they're smart and they work hard. And when you're smart and you work hard, then you have some great potential to at least creating something economical. And so China has moved about 400 million people out of dire poverty. And so that is encouraging. In fact, to look at poverty just for a whole couple of years like we have, there is lots of reason to be encouraged around the world about what's going on. Africa is finally giving up on socialism, and Africa also is making a pivot. We already know that India is making a pivot. The Prime Minister of India is saying, I was born Hindu, I'll die Hindu, but I got to tell you, anytime our religion creates business people, says that business people and traders and entrepreneurs are lower than the untouchables, there's something wrong with that. Every other place in the world, you celebrate entrepreneurs. And in India, we beat them over the head and consider them lower, the untouchables. So there's change going on in India, change going on in China. And so that is very, very encouraging. Okay, we have to step in to a voting booth. And I would just like to hear you. And here's the way I'd like to do this, and we'll see if this works. If this doesn't work, I'm going to go to plan B. And if plan B doesn't work, I'm going to go to plan C. So I've got two plans right after this plan. So if this plan doesn't work, but I need, Ron, the microphone. And here's what I need. What do you think that this election is mainly about? And if you want to pontificate on that just a second, then you go ahead and do that. And if you don't pontificate on what you're going to say, I get to pontificate on it. See? So let's do it that way. Instead of letting me lead the charge, let's just see what you think this election that's coming up, what do you think it's mainly about or kind of about or should be about? And we'll just let you just name the topic or pontificate on the topic, and then I get to jump on the topic. Okay, here we go. Ron, we're going to go here, and then Ron, after she's done, then over here. Okay. But this gentleman right there. Okay. Right here. Right here. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay.
I would call it the fiscal cliff or the deficits.
I just don't have anything to say about the fiscal cliff and deficits. Could we go on to the next one? You're going to think I set her up, aren't you? Oh, thank you. The fiscal cliff and the deficits. Look at, friends. Here's where we are. Debt and deficits. Our debt, our national debt, has been between 30 and 50% of the gross domestic product. So here's how much our country produces in a whole year, GDP. Here it is. And our debt has ranked between 30 and 50% over 40 years. So the benchmark is that, if your debt stays somewhere in this range of 30 to 50%, it's doable, it's tolerable, and et cetera. But when debt starts to go to 100% of your GDP, which we are in now, just as a frame of reference, in Japan, the debt is about 250%. Of its GDP. GDP's here. And in Greece, it's about that high. So the two worst countries probably in the world are Japan and Greece. And so the statement for them, it's over. It's done. It's cooked. It's baked into the cake. There is really no way Japan is going to get out of this. And Japan has another problem. Japan has not had any population growth. It's had a low population, so they're not replacing themselves. And so Japan is truly, truly, truly a bug in search of a windshield. And it's going to find it very soon. Greece is cooked. They don't have a clue as far as economics. They have no semblance of sense when it comes to economics. Now you're going to say, so does that mean Greece is going to topple into the ocean? No. The Germans will bail out the Greeks. That's what I predict. I'm not sure of that. But Germany is so rich. Let's just put it this way. Greece is kind of like Maryland. So let's act like we're all from all 49 states in the United States, and here's little Maryland over here. And Maryland is ready to sink. And now the question to the other 49 states is, so are we going to do something about Maryland? And one of you says, gee, it's not New York, it's not California, it's not Texas, it's not Ohio, it's not Pennsylvania. Please, it's Maryland. Yes. So I think the Germans are going to bail out the Greeks. I think the Germans are going to bail out the Portuguese. Then when the Italians and Spain comes with their hat in hand, I think that's when the Germans have to make up their mind, have I been born as a German to bail out the insanity of all this European nonsense? And I think that's when Germany is going to say, I don't think so. But for the moment, so I think Greece and Japan's in trouble, can't get out. So here we are. We're 50%. What does that mean? When our debt is 50% of our 100% of our GDP, the red lights are flashing. The red lights are flashing because when you build up this much debt, that debt has to be paid for. And so the interest, just the interest payments on the national debt, start taking a bigger and bigger portion of your income, which you would like to use for other productive things, but you can't because you're just paying back the interest on the debt. So you start reaching a point that this becomes untenable. Now, you wouldn't know it by the White House. And here's why you wouldn't know it by the White House. There's two brands of economics. There's free market, limited government, entrepreneurship, private ownership, protected property rights. That's all one set of economics. And this would be Milton Friedman, the University of Chicago. This would be public choice. This would be Arthur Laffer and supply side economics. This would be public choice economics. So that's that set of economics. And I would say the average economics professor at a university, you might have between one-third and one-half of the economics department embracing this set of ideas. The other set of ideas over here is called Keynesian economics. Keynesian for John Maynard Keynes, K-E-Y-N-E-S. He wrote his great book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. And Keynes said this. You know, interestingly, mathematically, the government multiplier is a little bit more powerful than the consumer and the investment multiplier. Mathematically, it looks like that if somehow government spends the money, it'll have more impact on the economy than over here if the private sector, etc., and consumers and investors spend the money. Now, as an economist, I can tell you, you really can mathematically show that this is true. What you can't show is that that theory really works in actual practice. For example, Japan went into recession 25 years ago, and Japan, three different times, has used this impact of government spending to try to blow Japan and give Japan liftoff, and at least $3 trillion, only it's in yen, $3 trillion of government impact to get this economy going, and yet Japan continues to be in this terrible, terrible recession. The group of economists over here would just simply say that Keynesian economics doesn't work. Now, I would have thought that we would have kicked off this set of ideas when Ronald Reagan lowered the marginal tax rate from 70 to 50 to 28%, and we proceed to have the best 25 years of economics ever in the history of the United States. We go from 1983 through 2006 or 7, and that is just an amazing 25-year period of time. And it was not done with Keynesian economics. It was done with supply side. It was done with lowering marginal tax rates, protecting property rates, trying to deregulate the economy, blah, 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 those set of ideas. And they seem to work in many nations that tried them, Singapore, Hong Kong, South Korea, to name some, were very, very successful employing these set of ideas. But all of a sudden, we have this administration that jumps us all the way back. The problem with these ideas, here you want less government. This one, you want more government. And if you're one of these people that want more government, if you're not a Christian, question, and I'm not saying they are or not, but if a whole bunch are not, what do you live for? You live for saving the planet. You live for government solving all the problems. The first 10 years I was out of the university, I was a huge, huge liberal. And it was so much fun. I got to tell you, it's way more fun. There's no end to the good that do-gooders will do with other people's money. It was so much fun. Divide the wealth. Listen to that. Divide the wealth. Spread it about. Sharing is no sin. When mine runs out, I plan to shout, let's divvy up again. So it's wonderful. And so to spend someone else's money, you never spend your own money, of course. You know, you spend someone else's money to solve all the problems. And so that's this government paradigm. And they're all Keynesians. And do you think, that President Obama is concerned about the fiscal cliff? He shows no signs of it. He doesn't even deliver up a budget that you can discuss. And another 4 years of this will mean another $1 trillion per year of deficit. Here's what's going on now, the last 6 years. Federal government takes in $2.5 trillion of tax revenue and spends $3.5 trillion. Now, we've done that 6 years in a row. We take in $2.5 trillion of federal tax revenue and we spend $3.5 trillion. That's like me making $50,000 a year and spending $85,000. Make $50,000, spend $85,000. Make 50. Well, you meet me one day and say, Barry, I think what you're doing is unsustainable. You can't make that model work. And yet they seem to not be overly concerned about this trillion, 6 years of a $1 trillion deficit, which has now put our national debt up to 15 or 16 trillion, and our GDP is 16 trillion. In other words, the debt to GDP ratio. So the fiscal cliff is that we're going to come to January 1 and all the Bush tax cuts, the tax cuts that came in 2001, the tax cuts that came in 2003, the reduction of capital gains tax, the forcing the corporate tax rate up to 35%, all that goes back to normal. We're going to go back to higher marginal tax rates, higher corporate tax rates, higher capital gains tax rates. And now here would be the problem with that. I don't think for a minute I could convince President Obama of this argument. But the problem there is that when your Social Security is $40 trillion of unfundable debt and your Medicare is maybe $60-65 trillion, you're talking about a lot of debt that we have no idea how we're going to pay for, and we just keep pushing it, kicking the can down the road. It would seem the worst thing you could do is to raise taxes on people who make $200,000 to $1 million. Now I got to tell you something. America is wonderful for a million reasons. But one reason why America is just so wonderful is that if Bill Gates came in this room right now and came up and sat down and began to visit with you, not one of you would say, you know what, that guy's worth $80 billion. And that's just not fair. And that's just not right. And so, Bill, we're sorry, but we're going to have to take a whole bunch of that away from you and spread it around. Not one of us would do that. And I love Americans because we don't have envy. We don't sit here and say, because apparently we realize an economic truth, that when you attack the rich, you really kill the poor. Bill Gates, he's worth $80 billion. You know that he can't even take a tiny percentage of that and eat it all, drive it all, live in it all, travel in it all. It's just tiny. So where does the rest of it go? Investment and jobs and make you and I more well off. I've said many times, but if Gates came right down this hall, and I'd say, Mr. Gates, I apologize. I've been buying Windows. The first time I bought Windows was Windows 91, then Windows 95, then Windows, a couple $100. It's worth thousands to me, tens of thousands to me. Bill, I'm sticking it to you. You should charge me more. But all Bill has to do is get a few $100 from each of you, and there's his $80 billion. So that's what I love about America. We're just not going to let envy get us down. And, oh, by the way, just as a little side story, it is precisely the problem in Africa. In Africa, a family will not let the sun set until it's all divided equal at the end of the day. And so if you have a great aunt that gives you $100, and let's say you're a woman, and you say, oh, great, if I can get another 100, I can buy a sewing machine. There is no way she'll ever buy a sewing machine. Why? She's not going to get to keep her $100 at the end of the day. She's got to divide it up with her children and her family and her husband and her aunts and uncles and friends, even. So at the end of the day, the $100 is gone, and she no longer has $100. Whereas you and I say, let her keep the $100 and the next $100 and the next $100, or in Bill Gates's, let Bill keep the 78th billion, the 79th billion, and the 80th billion. We're really saying the same. We're just saying, no, he earned it fair and square, and that's going to be invested. That's going to create jobs. And so to attack the rich is to attack the poor, and yet those folks would never believe that. So those tax, instead of now, we make the 2001-2003 tax cuts permanent, it looks like we're going to let them revert back to their higher rates. And here's the problem. In times of recession, it's the worst thing, my opinion, you could possibly do. You want to harness the power of incentives. And you harness the power of incentives, not by raising taxes, but by lowering taxes. And so I'm quite convinced that that President Romney would freeze those tax cuts and make them permanent. I think he would lower the corporate tax rate from 35 down to, say, 20 to 25%. I think he would leave well enough alone as far as capital gains taxes. And I think we need all of those kinds of things to harness the power of incentives to start increasing prosperity. He was at our think tank for half a day. He indicated us a couple things. One is he indicated that maybe to give, to repatriate a lot of money that is in foreign lands that would like to come back but is not going to come back because we're going to slam them with a high tax rate. What about, say, you bring it back in this period of time and you have a 5 or 10% tax rate, period. We've done that before and it works. And so I think right there we might bring $2 trillion back into play into the American economy. The second thing is, when you say we're going to make the 2001-2003 tax cuts permanent, now you're telling entrepreneurs, here are the rules of the game. Here are the playing rules. And that's very, very helpful. Because on top of those tax increases, you have what Obamacare is going to mean in higher costs. So the fiscal cliff indeed is a fiscal cliff. I think this administration is just very happy that we drive off. I think they're going to be tickled pink that we can raise taxes on the rich. The president seems kind of obsessed with this notion. Next question.
I think this election is about whether we remain a free people or move into slavery and under a tyrannical government.
Folks, F.A. Hayek wrote a great book in 1944 called The Road to Serfdom. And it really, really is a famous, famous book, The Road to Serfdom. And F.A. Hayek has turned out to be one of those guys in this camp. He's an Austrian, Ludwig von Mises and F.A. Hayek, and to a degree, Joseph Schumpeter. I didn't mention that. So you have the supply setters and the Friedmanites and the monetarists, blah, blah. But Hayek is over here. And his concern was we were on the road to serfdom. And his concern, if he was living this moment, is that we're really, really on the road to serfdom. Why I think this is such an important question is because even though we are on the road to serfdom, the road to freedom is not that far off that we can't maybe hop off of this baby and get on the right road. But here's the problem with 4 more years of President Obama, as you then locked in Obamacare. And Obamacare is reality today, and it becomes even more reality in the ensuing 4 years. And so these roads are now so getting so far apart that it almost becomes impossible to jump off of the road to serfdom onto the road to freedom. And so it is an election on that very thing. What do we want to be the size of our government? Once again, to quote Romney on a couple things. First of all, how have we financed a lot of this? Through debt. How have we done that? QE1, QE2, and QE3. QE is quantitative easing by Bernanke. Three times quantitative, or another way of saying it, is print money to finance this government largesse. Just print money. Now, a bunch of you are thinking, my gosh, if we've done three QE3s and we're printing money like there is no tomorrow, why aren't we going to have enormous rates of inflation? Thanks. That's a good question. And the answer to that is because at the same time, we're printing this money and creating, it could create huge inflation. We have a country demographically that a whole bunch of us are between the ages right now of 45 and 70. The interesting thing about the ages from 45 to 70, you start deleveraging, you start downsizing. I was with a couple in Oklahoma City just a couple days ago. They live in a big Frank Lloyd Wright home in Oklahoma City. I've never seen anything like it. And when I told them that Tellison is going to move out of Arizona and is going to move to New York City, their hearts just broke because they just love that. But anyway, but they're in about 5,000 or 6,000 square feet in this unbelievable house. And so are you two just going to stay here? No, no. There's no way we want to manage. She says, it takes me 8 hours to mow the lawn. 8 hours. And I'm starting to get weary of 8 hours to mow the lawn. So this is a big spread and a big home. Deleveraging. They are downsizing. That couple in Oklahoma City is representative of everybody between ages 45 and 65 or 70. You just need less housing and you begin to downsize. And you don't really need the income that you did when your family was young and you needed cars for everybody and when they all had to be educated in college and you all had to get them all married. And but that happens even for Mandy and I now. We've married our daughter and just a year ago right now. And as I was ready to walk her down the aisle, the tears were just busting out of my eyes. And I was going to lose it. And Angela just grabbed me hard and looked over and she says, Dad, think of how much this wedding cost. Boy, that just... That dried my eyes. That dried my eyes. I mean, she couldn't have said anything that would have sobered me quicker than to walk down the aisle and say, man, this... So anyway, but the point is, so you have a nation downsizing, you have a nation deleveraging, at the same time you have a government spinning out of their mind, but this effect is obviously somehow balancing this effect. Because although we have some inflation, you've seen what happened in food prices, you've seen what's happened in energy prices, so there's some areas in the economy, there's no question that we've seen some inflation, and it's sitting there and could rile up and could devour us, really. It's scary. But at the same time, this downsizing is not going to go away. It is true. It is absolutely true what's going on there. So, by the way, when you think about 90,000 unoccupied houses in Phoenix, maybe it's not quite that high anymore. You know, when Romney was out of the think tank, President Romney, look at the United States is educating 700,000 foreign students per year, 700,000. Many of them are chemists and biologists and mathematicians and engineers, and many of them would stay if we had visas and green cards. But we just don't have the number of visas and green cards to encourage those students to stay in the United States. The interesting thing, we want to do it for a number of reasons. One, we educated them. They can, for a while, at least a while, make a great contribution to our country, but they would be eligible to start getting into the housing market, and they would. They would be buying houses, et cetera, et cetera. And that is one way to start look at some of the empty, unoccupied houses by readdressing how we feel about immigration. I know this was not the question, immigration. This is so me. Pretty soon I'm going to be talking about putting Firestone tires on my car. You'll see. But it does connect, kind of. Immigration does. It connects because you, like me, are very uncomfortable with illegal immigrants. However, the blame cannot be so much on them. Look, if you could live in Tijuana and drive cab for $5 a day, or go 5 miles over here to San Diego and drive cab and make $200 a day, would you prefer to make five, or would you prefer to make 200? Look, America is cornucopia. It's like no place on the face of the earth. No wonder they all want to come. No wonder they all want to come. And with a lot of them, we encouraged it. We encouraged you to come to the restaurants. We encouraged you to come and pick the fruit. We encouraged you to come and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, yes, the speed limit said 60. Everybody was driving 70. And all of us were driving 70. And all of a sudden, we wake up one day and say, whoa, whoa, we're going to now throw you in jail because you're now driving the 70. Well, I know I'm driving 70. So it's kind of that kind of deal. My point is that we've done a lot of encouraging of them to come. And now that they've come, the pain of trying to figure out how to get 10 to 15 million people back to Mexico is just kind of beyond comprehension. So it seems to me, so that we can have peace, we say we've got to somehow get these people on a 5 or 10 year track to citizenship, and we have to control our borders in the future and begin to use this magnificent students that are already educated here so that we keep increasing the number of educated people that are receiving visas and green cards and entrance in this country instead of very, very poor, illiterate people that don't. So that's not the perfect answer, but that's our recommendation that we gave to Romney. Okay, next question. Right here. Okay, right where? Okay.
I think the basic problem is individual responsibility. When I first moved, I was here for 3 years in 72 through 75, and Barry Goldwater was a client, and Judy Eisenhower was his administrative assistant. And I asked him, I said, Barry, what are the key issues in your life that you try to live by? He didn't talk a lot about God. At first, he said Arizona, family, Arizona, and then the United States. Well, I'm from Texas, and I connected immediately. Yeah. But mine was God, my individual responsibility to God, family, Texas, and then the United States.
But both times, Texas was in there. I like that.
Listen, it's good to see a little laughing because there's an awful lot of tears being shed today. As Yogi Berra said, wherever you are, be there. Well, when I was there in Arizona for 3 years, I was in Arizona. Now, I tried never to say Texas, but my accent gave me away. I'm here again, and I'm a Cardinal fan.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah.
The individual responsibility with the one party, he is an entrepreneur. He took personal responsibility. He went out and did his thing. The other is entitlements. And when I started out of college in 1960, the debt to equity ratio, if the debt exceeded 4 to 1, the company was in trouble, and you started trying to figure out a way. So individual responsibility, if I borrow the money to buy a house and I can't afford it in the first place, the government shouldn't bail me out.
Yeah. Oh, you make the best point in the whole world, and it's still the point that most Americans that most Americans still would say, okay, what happened in 2008 through 2011 with that terrible, terrible recession? And most would say the market went wild, greed went wild, blah, 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 blah. That's what most people would say. But I've got to tell you that any time the federal government is going to back $2 trillion of subprime loans and guarantee that $2 trillion. Please understand how big $2 trillion is. $2 trillion is about the same size as Germany. So everything now that Germany produces this year, everything, and Germany's the fourth largest country in the world, we're going to take all of that and we're going to give it to unqualified buyers to get into homes and then guarantee those loans. So who's ever making those loans, you don't have to worry, don't worry. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac will go ahead and guarantee those loans. You throw the market system so out of whack, because certainly you should not be doing that. Certainly 1,000 teenage girls in San Francisco buying million-dollar homes, that does not make any sense. Certainly 20,000 teenage boys, multiple homeowners, two homes, three homes, four homes. They're 18 years old. They're multiple homes. All those homes guaranteed by Fannie Mae, all those homes guaranteed by government. Well, no, everything just got carried away to insanity. And now it's all collapsed on us. And now we have to dig our way out. And all those unoccupied homes have to become occupied again, blah, blah, blah. And we're trying to work through that. But government... This was when government passed the Community Reinvestment Act and said we want home ownership, if possible, to go to 100%. But if we can't get home ownership in this country to 100%, then at least we've got to get to 70. We're at 60 in their 70s. So we're going to push home ownership from 60% to 70%. Well, unfortunately, the people in this income category from 60 to 70 are mainly in the subprime category. And the loaners, the lenders said, you know what? We're not really in business to be making loans to unqualified buyers. The fact is, when I make a $1 million loan to this 18-year-old girl in San Francisco, and she's now in a $1 million home, nice. America is a wonderful place, but it really makes me wonder what is going to happen if home prices ever turn down and she can't do that. Well, she has to get out, and she does. And now everybody is left holding the bag. And that's what government did. So, and yet Barney Frank will take no responsibility for this. He just acts like he wasn't party to it. And Obama is getting away with this. Because even now, they're saying, it's still Bush. It's still Bush. It's still Bush. We still hear that. Can you imagine? Well, anyway. So I think personal responsibility is true. Hey, are we lucky? Okay, I'll come to this one. Are we lucky in America? Think about it. First of all, we get to go to a church that is probably one of the top 100 churches in the United States. Not that that's that big a deal, because you don't have to have this kind of size. You don't. We've all done little churches, big churches, and everything in between. But how fortunate we are to go to this kind of a church. How fortunate you are to have the kind of teacher that you have. I've told you this before, but everywhere Wayne Grudem goes in the world, he's a rock star. He is a rock star. They all want their picture taken with him. It's so funny. You just get used to him. To him, he's just like an old shoe. But we're so fortunate to have such a wonderful church. Nothing you've done, I've done. Talk about grace, and God just graces us with getting those priorities that you just mentioned. God first, always first. It's not much how much of my money I'm going to give to God. It's how much of God's money I'm going to keep for me. It's how much of God's money I'm going to keep for me. It's how much God's money I'm going to keep. Got it? That's got to be our attitude. And I think that's the way our church looks. So we're lucky there. But are we also graced with a country? You come back from South America, and most of the rivers in South America are not navigable. Most of them run very hard, especially the Amazon River. Oh my gosh, it runs 1,000,000 miles an hour and has 1,000,000 snakes in it with heads like this. And so we have the Mississippi, the Ohio, the Missouri. So we have such wonderful streams. We have the largest piece of contiguous fertile soil. Well, listen to this. There's only about 15 to 20 deep water ports in the whole world. And the United States has got about half of them on the East Coast and the West. So a lot of countries don't have any oceans. We have two, one on each side, with those beautiful streams, all that fertile soil. And then, to top all this, I'm going to come back. I'm going to come back and talk about two subjects in the next 6 months. One is healthcare, and we're going to just stick on that, because I just want you to see what a competitivized healthcare system might look like, especially in contrast to what Obama is pushing on us. And if he gets reelected, we will get down. There will be no getting off of that one. If he gets reelected, Obamacare will be the law of the land, will be in so deep, there's no way. We won't even know how to jump off the path because we can't even see the path. The freedom path and the collectivized path are so far apart. So this election is a critical, critical thing. But so we have deep water parts, most of them in the world. How fortunate we are. I mean, that's all you can say. And it's not all bad being Protestant in this sense. Wayne and I have looked at all the religions of the world, the most progressive religion in the world, Protestantism. Number two, right under that, Judaism. Three, right under that, Catholicism. Not that, they're both Christian. Catholicism is number three. And then the other religions, it falls off. It's down here. I mean, they are not progressive prone. Okay, next question.
This is related to this fish cliff. And the U.S. has really been on a free ride with its debt. Interest rates are at the lowest they have been, what, forever? And what do you think is going to happen when interest rates return to a normal, realistic level? And the cost of our debt is going to go up, what, two, three?
Yeah, see, that's the problem. Look, from an economic point of view, we have to allow interest rates to rise. But from a government point of view, it kills you because it doubles your national debt. So the only way you can... So, folks, here's kind of what happened here, if you want to know. About 30 years ago, governments, not just our government, but governments throughout the world... figured out something. There's a free lunch. What is that free lunch? You know what? We control interest rates. When you lower interest rates, people will borrow more. When people borrow more, they will spend more. Then you step back and you look at that spending. Wow, they bought a car, bought a shirt, bought a new belt. Wow, they're spending more. Well, gosh, what if we lowered interest rates even more? Then they will borrow more. Then they will spend more. And we go back and we look at it. It looks okay so far. Now, this is like building a sandcastle. And this sandcastle, look, just minutes before that thing collapses, it looks totally okay. You're walking around this sandcastle. See, economic life is okay until it's not okay. It's fine until it's not fine. It works until it doesn't work. But you don't know it's not fine, and you do not know it's not okay, and you know it until the darn thing collapses on you. So back to this story. So every government around the world kept lowering interest rates. Now folks, let's look at the four largest currencies in the world. The dollar, the pound, the euro, and the yen. The four biggest currencies in the world. It used to be that the standard interest rates for those four currencies, in our vernacular, our federal funds rate, we would ask the question that way. What was kind of a basic interest rate, we'll call it our federal funds rate, and what was it? Answer, 3 to 4%. So through the years, federal funds rate, 2%, 4%, 6%, back to 4, 3, 4, 3, 4. So now I can do that with you for the yen, and I can do that with the pound, and I can do that with the euro. The euro's only been around 30 years, but anyway, their standard interest rates were somewhere between 2 and 4%, okay? So you know what we're talking about here. Guess what? Do you want me to tell you what they are for those four currencies today? Are you ready for this? All of them, all four, less than 0.5%. In Japan, guess what there is? 0.1, 0.1%. That's what they'll pay you to save. Put your money in and we'll pay you 0.1%. Are you kidding me? But you don't worry about that. You say, the neat thing is, when you have interest rates that are the lowest they've ever, people will borrow more and buy more. Borrow more and buy. So now what happens here is consumer debt goes up and up and up. And we reach 2008, and consumer debt is such a thing, and that we're not even saving anymore. We just act like our savings is all in our home, and we don't even. But you're surely not going to save when they're only going to pay. You know what the federal funds rate is right now in this country? 0.25. 0.25. Have you ever heard of anything so incredible? And all four major currencies of the world are all under 0.5. I think the highest one right now is the euro at 0.5%. 0.5%. So when you lower interest rates, people borrow more. When they borrow more, they buy more. And so we've been on what you call a 30-year low interest, spend like mad buying cycle. And it had to come to an end. It is coming to an end. It is ending. And so we absolutely have to quit. So let's go back to Romney and Bernanke. I think Romney hurt himself when he said, if I become president, Bernanke's out of here. I think he hurt himself because Bernanke now can get back at him. He's going to lose his job if Romney wins. So what did Bernanke right away come up with? QE3. How sweet it is. $40 billion a month. $40 billion of new money. So exciting. It's so exciting. USA Today said, it looks like the recovery's pretty solid. Yeah, it's solid, all right. So anyway, but the point is, Romney wins, Bernanke's out. Out! 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 And we get back to some normalcy. Now, you can't raise the federal funds rate from 0.25% back up to 4% like that. You just break people's back. You've got to be mindful. I got it. But what you don't say is it's going to be 0.25 till the year 2015. That's what Bernanke said. And the market is counting on that, 0.25 till the year 2015. You don't say that because you have to begin getting interest rates back into their normal range. And it's not just us, dear friends. It's not just us. Let's act like you were Hungarian. And so you have your own currency. It's not a strong currency. And the interest rates to buy a home, 8 to 12%, sometimes 15%. So get in a new. Therefore, nobody in Hungary could buy a home. They couldn't. Then Hungary goes to the euro. The euro comes in. Now, the euro is a strong currency because Germany is a strong country. I mean, the euro is really undergirded by the German Deutschmark. And so that's a. But when you have a strong currency, then you don't have to have interest rates in skyrocketing up. They can be in the normal range of 3%. And the Hungarians were thrilled out of their minds to be able to maybe start buying some housing and get it at low interest rates. So the Hungarians were thrilled. Then the Swiss say, you know what, we can even beat that interest rate. If you go ahead and borrow the Swiss franc, we'll be able to get you into those homes for 1 to 1.5%. So the Hungarians go buying homes, going to have to pay 8, 10, 12% to the euro. Oh man, we can now get into those homes for 3%. Now we can go to the Swiss franc at 1% or 1.5%. And guess what all Hungarians did? They all borrowed money and bought homes for on the Swiss franc. Unfortunately, what's happened through life is the Swiss franc changed in midstream, and what they thought was a $100,000 turned out to be 75, and what they thought was 75 turned out to be 60. The currency switched on them, and that can happen in a minute. That's what happened. You know, when you're in the currency trading business, let me tell you, it's a volatile business. The point is, Hungary is just up a creek. All their folks are having to leave their homes. All their folks are having to vacate. All their folks can't get into a home. And so it is one pathetic mess in Hungary. A lot of Europe is a pathetic mess. And to be honest with you, this is going to come as a shock to most of you, perhaps the country that is in the worst shape here is the UK. I mean, it had its great glory days under Margaret Thatcher from 1979 through 1991. Those were the glory days of the UK. But I'm telling you, the UK has been crazy in their economics in the last 20 years. And I'm afraid that the UK is a bug in search of a windshield also. And then you add two of those kinds of problems when you have the new president of France, who literally goes on the microphone and says, I hate rich people, and I hope the rich people get out of here. What in the world is the president of a country talking that way? And look, he had no business winning that election, except guess how he did it. Sarkozy had raised the retirement from 60 to 62, which you have to do, by the way. That's what we have to do, too. Over a period of time, we've got to make Social Security viable by raising the retirement age slowly over the years. Don't throw anybody out, but do it. And then we're also going to have to do a little creativity as far as monthly payments on income. It's probably going to have to be adjusted that rich people will not quite get the same big Social Security check as people in the moderate to low income. But you do those things and you're back on Social Security. But Sarkozy got it from 60 to 62. Hollande wins the presidency of France by doing two things. One, he ran, I'm going to lower it from 62 back to 60. And then two nights before the election, he went on national TV and he says he's had a change of heart. Yes? Yes. I think maybe if we could get retirement to 55. Would that win votes or what? Did that win votes or what? Did he win the presidency of France? Yes, he did. See what I mean? The more nonsensical, the more crazy, the more non-economical, the more over the cliff, the more people will vote. That's why our founding fathers were so scared of democracy. That's why our founding father says democracy is simply two wolves and one sheep voting for what we're going to have for dinner. That's why many have said that an election is just an advanced auction on stolen goods. It's basically unstable because the takers can overwhelm the makers. And so this group is the makers, and they work hard, and they create, and they're entrepreneurial, and they save, and they're frugal, and all blah, blah, blah. Thrilling, thrilling. But what if this group, none of those things, happens to be, though, 51%? 51 whips the 49. This group, the takers, overwhelm the makers. Now, I realize that Romney, when he said that, he got his head sliced off, and he still can't live that one down. But it is the truth. When 47% of your population doesn't pay any income tax, they have no skin in the game. With no skin in the game, guess what? How they like to vote? More.
Next question. Ron, are we okay, or what? We got to wrap it up? No? Okay. Hey, well, look, I've got leverage on Grudem, so he's going to let me come back. And thank you. Uh-oh.
Thanks, Ron.